Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. The goal of the 1950s urban relocation program by the Bureau of Indian Affairs was controversial. It was designed to address poverty on Native reservations. But many who entered the program say the federal government failed to live up to all its promises, and many Native Americans became exiles from the reservations they knew. Still, many people found each other and formed a new urban community. Stay tuned as we discuss the legacy of this era right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Haskell Indian Nations University students have worked since last fall on getting their city commission to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day annually. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, their hard work paid off last week in Lawrence, Kansas.
The Lawrence City Commission voted unanimously to adopt Resolution Number 7154, establishing Indigenous Peoples Day as an annual recurring event in Lawrence, Kansas, the home to Haskell Indian Nations University. Lawrence Mayor Mike Amick stated in his comments that he was supportive of the resolution.
Like I say, I think this is a very special time to be able to pass such a resolution.
Haskell students prepared the document to take to the meeting where no one spoke against the resolution. Haskell student Lori Hasselman says they were pleased with the outcome.
I think we're just really excited to continue the Indigenous Peoples celebration on an annual basis and be able to make those connections and educate the community and celebrate our differences.
The resolution designates the second Monday of October as Indigenous Peoples Day. Hasselman says students are more than happy to continue the celebration each fall. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
A coalition of tribes is continuing to work to protect the Bears Ears area in Utah. They want federal protection, but face opposition by some state leaders. Tribal leaders are hopeful the area will be designated a national monument and point to an upcoming visit to Utah by U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. Mark Richardson has more.
The Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition is seeking to protect the area, which it says has significant cultural and historic meaning. The coalition includes the Hopi Tribe, Navajo Nation, Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, Pueblo of Zuni, and Ute Indian Tribe. Carlton Boacott, a councilman with the Pueblo of Zuni, says the area was home to many of their ancestors.
The reason why these areas are so important to us is it allows us to reconnect to our history. Our history is passed orally, and a lot of our prayers and history comes through in certain terms we don't always understand.
The region contains massive Red Rock canyons, high mesas, and more than 100,000 Native American archaeological and cultural sites. However, Boacott says it remains largely unprotected and is threatened by looting and off-road vehicle damage. Mark Richardson reporting.
Some 500 young people from Alaska gathered last week in Anchorage for the Native Youth Olympics to compete in traditional games. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes reports.
Marjorie Taubone, a coach for the team from Nome, says determination and optimism that you can reach your goal are important in the games. Height helps in some games, such as high kicks. Small stature and endurance help in games, such as the wrist carry, where the athlete hangs by a wrist wrapped around a pole being carried around the arena. The winner is the one who hangs on for the greatest distance. Taubone says the one-arm reach calls for strength and balance, as athletes hold up their entire body on one hand while stretching to reach a suspended ball with the other.
It just takes amazing body control and strength to be able to do that.
Taubone says Inuit people from Canada, Greenland, and Russia practiced these and similar games, building the strength, agility, and reflexes needed to successfully hunt and gather food, while also passing on cultural values. Taubone says NYO fosters supportive competition, where athletes encourage and coach one another to do their best.
A good leader helps and makes their community grow, and that's exactly what these kids are doing when they're helping each other.
Cook Inlet Tribal Council organizers say that in a 2015 poll, students also credited NYO with helping them form new friendships and providing incentives to stay in school and make better grades. I'm Jocelyn Estes reporting in Anchorage.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. The stated goal of the Bureau of Indian Affairs Urban Relocation Program in the 50s was to help address poverty in rural reservations. Thousands of natives moved to a handful of cities where they were promised more job opportunities. The legacy of relocation created challenges for different natives. Some of those who moved away lost connections to their tribal culture and the ability to exercise their sovereign rights on their homelands. Others came away from these times with a different take on life, including a chance for something new, a foundation for a burgeoning urban native landscape. And we'll take a look inside these urban communities today and see how those who relocated evolved and created and maintained a strong tie to a native life. And we want to know, was your family affected by relocation? Are you the product of the relocation era? And have you maintained your native roots? Give us a call and join the conversation. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And now joining us from Los Angeles, California, is Pamela Peters. She's a multimedia Indigenous documentarian, and she is Navajo. It's our pleasure to welcome her back to the hour. Hello, Pamela.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Pamela, thanks for being here. And it's interesting when we think about natives living in the city, but it is definitely a part of people's history. And there are large populations of natives living in cities today. I think I'm reminded of the statistic that sometimes there's more natives in the city than there are in our communities. So Pamela, take us back a little bit. Los Angeles has ties to your life. Tell us why this is so.
Well, I moved out to Los Angeles in the late 80s when I was a teenager, and I've lived here ever since, and so that's basically my ties. And in the last couple of years, I started doing a lot of multimedia work and kind of bringing to light the Native American experience here in Los Angeles, and that's what my work all serves around. And with the relocation program, I started that project as a beginning of how a lot of tribal nations from reservations came to large cities. And when I was talking to my mother about it, she told me, you know, I was part of the whole relocation program. And I was really surprised because I was born and raised on the reservation. And I didn't realize that my mom and my dad were part of the program back in the 50s, and she told me that the BIA had an agency, I guess, in Gallup, and my dad and his buddy, I guess, went to the agency, and they signed up, and they promised them, you know, training, vocational training, and a new life, the American dream. And so my mom and dad and my oldest sister, who was born on the res, they moved up to Oakland. And they lived in Oakland for about 6 years. And I didn't know anything about that until I started doing the work that I'm doing. And when I started asking people here in the Los Angeles community, I realized there was a large number of people that have lived here through the relocation program. And the more research that I did and, you know, capturing clippings from newspapers and such. And I realized that Los Angeles has one of the largest population of Native Americans. And I know it's debatable, but I really think and believe that it does have the largest population than any other city.
And you know, Pamela, often we hear lots of stories of people who do have ties to Los Angeles or family members who are there who they've never met. And I think it's really interesting to open up the discussion in this way to think about why some of our Native communities are thriving in urban centers. And folks, if you'd like to help piece the story together with us today when we talk about relocation and our Native nations moving to some of these urban centers, what would you like to share? Have those stories ever been shared with you about your parents or grandparents and being a part of the relocation program? Good or bad, we want to hear. 1-800-996-2848. And Pamela, when you think of all the Natives that you're connected to there in Los Angeles, have you ever kind of put together a number of how many of them that you know of are there because of relocation?
I know that I when I did my research and I was looking at newspaper clippings, they had projected there was about 12,000 Natives that moved out here during the 60s. And then that number jumped to 25,000 in the 70s. And then it jumped to 75,000 in the 80s and then 100,000 in the 90s. And some of the stats that I've read, it's indicated that it's roughly between 150 and 175,000 Natives that live here in the city.
Wow, those numbers are extremely high. And Pamela, I think it's interesting, too, what you're sharing, that some of the propaganda that was given to Native folks or what they were told as, you know, the finger was pointing to a big city. Can you share some of that with us? Because there's some interesting stuff there.
Oh, the relocation program?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it was created by the BIA. It was a voluntary program, and it was... It was an act that was part of the termination policy, and it encouraged young adults that were coming out of boarding school to return, that were returning back to their tribal land. And the government, I don't know if a lot of people understand what was happening with the termination policies at that time, but the United States government wanted to release diminish the relationship it had with tribal nations. And it was determining what tribes they could immediately, you know, remove federal help from. And so part of the termination policy was relocation. And the relocation program had three real main goals. First, it wanted to decrease those subsidies given to Natives living on reservations, even though those subsidies were granted in exchange for land ceding during our treaty negotiation with the government. And secondly, the policy wanted to deceitfully take more land that they found out through the surveys that they were doing in the 20s and 30s of the rich resources they found. And they needed those resources for capital and community expansion, because cities were growing. And this was after the Great Depression, where a lot of different communities were moving westward. And then thirdly, it needed cheap labor to help in the workforce for the urban expansions. But they didn't tell American Indians through the relocation program that they were going to go to the cities competing for these jobs. They gave them the false intentions that, oh, these jobs are already set up for you. That wasn't necessarily the case. And so I think those were the three main deceitful intent that the United States government wanted. And they were hoping that Natives would move to the city and stay in the city and never go back to their reservation because they wanted more land.
And Pamela, times were extremely hard during, you know, this time period. And I know family members, when they share their reasons for going out and into some of these cities as a part of this program, is they really thought that they were going to be able to pick up a trade and get running with it and actually make some money. And that wasn't the case for many people. Folks, if you'd like to share anything about the history of relocation, why many Native people moved to urban centers in the 50s or any other time period, you can give us a call. And do you ever think back to how these stories come about and what people say about relocation? And then do you think about it in your own life? Is there a modern relocation happening today? How did the two times compare? Anything you'd like to share, we're excited to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Pamela, we're going to say hi to a caller. We're going to bring in Roy, who is in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening today online. Roy, thank you for reaching out to us. And what would you like to share?
You're welcome, Tara. And hello, Pamela. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the context in which Pamela is describing. I think we also have to remember that termination and relocation together during the 50s was really the culmination of a lot that was going on with the federal government and, you know, the Native nation. So if you trace it all the way back to the Indian removal era, all the way back up to the future or the present, like the Indian Reorganization Act in the 30s as well. So this was just a long line of federal intervention, you know, trying to break up the Native nations and trying to assimilate or civilize Native peoples as well. And, you know, I can tell you from my own perspective, doing some research on this because it's been interesting to me, you know, there's an excellent resource out there called Reimagining Indian Country by Nicholas Rosenthal, and he's a professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. And he's written about the experience in the Los Angeles area as well. You know, also Dylan Meyer, who was responsible for this program in the Department of Interior, a special commissioner or had a special portfolio, he was also responsible for the relocation of Japanese American citizens during World War II. So moving them from the West Coast into the interior. So sort of a an opposite effect, you know, primarily under the guise of national security. So it's interesting to see his role in that. But I can tell you, my parents, I'm a Pawnee, and my mother was a Choctaw, so I'm enrolled Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma. I'm in Minneapolis now. I've been here about 35 years. So I guess you could say that the urban experience really took with me because I've lived primarily in urban centers. But they went out to Los Angeles in 1957, and they stayed for a couple of years. They returned back to Oklahoma, where they were both from, and then of their own volition, they went back out to Los Angeles. And so that's where I actually started elementary school, and I like to say that I think a lot of my success professionally and outside of the non-Indian world is the direct result of the high quality of the California schools at that time. So I think I completed seventh or eighth grade. My memory is kind of failing me at this point. I'm 59 years old. But and then we returned to Oklahoma. But, you know, I have vague memories of playing in the streets downtown Los Angeles near the Olympic Coliseum. We then moved out to the South Bay area where there were, it was like a small colony or enclave of people from many different tribes. As Pam is talking about, from the Southwest, from Oklahoma, from the Dakotas as well. I don't recall as many Native California natives from there in Los Angeles at the time. But I, you know, my parents both took great, made great effort to try and maintain our traditions. You know, I'm not fluent in one of my languages, but you know, can try and put together some phrases and questions and descriptive words. Certainly, the religious traditions were a little more difficult to maintain. We did have the Native American church with the use of peyote that was there as well. And then, you know, the burgeoning powwow, the urban powwow that was there as well. And while I don't sit at the drum or have regalia and dance to this day, you know, I do have those memories of a lot of, you know, tribal friendships and interaction in an urban environment as far back as the early 60s.
Wow, Roy. Well, we do appreciate you sharing a bit of that. And just hearing your story, I know there are others who it really resonated with because similar things happen. Also mentioning that you saw some positive things come of this. That's great to hear different perspectives. Roy, thank you for your call there in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening online. And folks, we know our airwaves reach many places across the nation, including urban places. If there's anything you'd like to share about relocation, moving to the city, and we're also wondering, how do you maintain your native life? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Let's take another call. We're going to say hi to Mike in Buffalo Springs, New Mexico, listening on KGLP. Mike, thanks for calling, and you're on air.
Yes, hey, Ben, I just wanted to comment that my dad and uncles and stuff, a lot of them, they were caught up in that program, and my dad worked in San Francisco area with Bethlehem Steel. My uncles were in Barstow, California, and L.A. And the one thing I learned from them is that a lot of the natives that went for this promise of jobs and stuff like that, when they got there, they suffered a lot, and they're coming home with not much because they didn't understand the economic situations of paying city, state, federal taxes, and all that stuff. So a lot of them lost their homes, livelihood, many of them coming back to the rest. In
sure.
My own time and era, it's been pretty much the same, and a lot of the people moving off the rest nowadays in my time is due to economic development. There's zero and jobs, there's zero, and most everybody's relocating off the rest where they have a better chance of making a living, and that's our own government's problem. They're trying to deal with it, but it's like they're spinning their wheels all the time.
Sure, Mike.
Making no headway.
There's a lot to consider. Mike, always great to hear from you there in Buffalo Springs. Let's take another call. We're going to say hi to Elton in Rapid City, South Dakota, listening today on KILI Keeley Radio. Elton, thank you for your call, and you're on air.
Yes, good morning for listening to me. Hey, I'm from Pioneer Ridge Reservation, second largest reservation throughout the United States. And she was a girl was talking about the Relocation Act. And I remember my father, I'm going to be 66 years old, and I remember my father when we did go to Relocation Act. We were up in L.A. and Oakland, that area. And ever since then, after we had left there, so the training he took, you know, we never really moved back to reservation because everything he learned was kind of learned from that Relocation Act that he went on. And he never did ever move back to reservation. And then he helped him a lot because as he grew in his training and whatever and being out there, he became a contractor, self-employed. And even to this day, I am a contractor and self-employed. Plus, I went to college and got a lot of stuff done that I'm supposed to. But he learned a lot out there, and what he learned, he passed on to me, that survival is out there. And one of the things that tribe, the BI in Pine Ridge, they were wanting to see if the Native American could make it out there, could take that training and make it out there and survive out there. That's one of the things that they were looking at in Pine Ridge, as I remember my dad telling me years ago.
All right, Elton, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing your family's story as well. And Pamela, just hearing Elton talk about picking up a trade, both negative and positive things, this is a common story. A lot of people went out to these different places, picked up a trade, and then at home, you know, there weren't those factories or places where you could continue picking up some of this. Pamela, is there any more perspective you want to add to that?
I think a lot of people did learn and, you know, take advantage of the program and really utilize what the training programs were entailed for. I really am happy that some people were able to take that and take it back home to their reservations and utilize it, and also just like Elton has today. I also was listening to Mike and what he was saying about, you know, not knowing the economics of living in a city. And that was one thing the program never shared with these young adults coming out of boarding school and going to the city. They didn't give them any training of how to live in the city. They didn't give them any training of like how to save their money and how they have to pay their rent. And there is a movie that I based one of my projects out of, which is The Exiles. And there's these scenes where you see all these young adults living in a small apartment. And I was talking to my mom about that, and she said, you know, when we lived upstairs, we had like four people in a one-bedroom apartment. And she goes, and there was other people. There was like six people in a one-bedroom apartment. So there were people that didn't that really utilized the skills that they could obtain through the program, but then there were some that didn't know how. And when they got a job, they didn't know how to establish and find their place within the city. So there's both good and bad that came out of it.
Sure, and we can be realistic about this. Young kids in the city with money, not a lot of training on how to live there or balance their budget, and just the allure of being in a city and having fun. I'm sure that created a lot of challenges. And Pamela, I'm glad you mentioned that film, Exiles, because it gives a pretty interesting take. The documentarian grew from stories that he said were people's stories and kind of mixed it up and meshed it together. So some of what you see in that film is based on a real people's story. And so, Pamela, we're going to get ready to go to the break here, and we're going to continue this discussion. But there is definitely a lot to talk about when we talk about the relocation era, and especially when we reconnected to what's going on today. You heard Pamela share a bit of what her family faced, and as well as other callers, what their families face. Does any of this sound familiar to what's going on today? And what about picking up a trade somewhere in an urban center and coming home and not finding a place to apply it? Does that also sound familiar? Folks, you can join us. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We're going to continue visiting with Pamela Peters. She is a multimedia Indigenous documentarian, and she is Navajo. And she'll be with us for the full hour. And if there's anything you would like to share in this conversation but can't quite get to the phone, you can always reach out to us on social media, on Facebook, or you can send us a tweet. 1-800-99-NATIVE is our handle. And we're also wondering, what about some of these centers where Native people got together? Do you have anything to share on that side of the story? What about when we talk about pan-Indian communities? Are some of its roots resting within the era of relocation? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We're going to meet another guest right after the break, but we do look forward to hearing from you. And we're going to go ahead and give you a little bit on what is coming up tomorrow on our electronic talking circle. But while you're here, you can still reach out to us by calling in 1-800-996-2848, 1-800-99-NATIVE. The people immortalized in bronze statues, the names given to mountains and rivers, and even the faces on currency mean different things to different people. What happens when those being honored are offensive to Native nations? Should they be replaced? That's our discussion on the next Native America Calling.
Buju. Migawin Mainwaich Jiwebinud Gijuniam. Gedayan Mazanaigas, Jidabayge Siwan, Ijiwiniguyan Akwasiwigamigung. Bindage Biagason. Ganoj 1-800-318-2596. Gema Mawadishuane, healthcare.gov/tribal. Gaundinagadeg, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Miigwech.
Welcome back. You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. And many Native families were affected by the urban relocation program of the 1950s. Thousands of Natives were enticed to leave their reservation homes to live in a handful of big cities across the country. And for those who relocated by way of the BIA program, homesickness was a big issue. So was poverty and an all-around lack of resources. Many feel the government failed to live up to promises of supporting people who went out during the transition. And for different reasons, some families had no choice but to stay in the cities. But there were others who returned to their reservations. And that's just one side of the story. We know there are positive stories that go along with this. We even heard earlier from a gentleman who was talking about picking up a trade and attributed some of this legacy to understanding how to make it in the world. And if there's anything you'd like to share, give us a ring. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. What do you want to say about relocation? 1-800-99-NATIVE is also the number. Our associate producer, Andy Murphy, talked with her mother, Kathy Murphy, about relocation. Here's Kathy sharing some memories of living in Los Angeles in the early 1960s.
I was about in third grade, and we used to walk to school every day. And I remember sometimes it would rain all week. So we would be walking to school with our umbrellas. I guess we were like any Native kid. We would ride our bikes through the water in the gutter on the street. Sometimes we would fold little papers to make them look like boats. We would put those little paper boats in the water and we would watch them go by. I mean, I remember those days when we were in California. We used to go taking drives through the, the residential areas in California during Christmas. We used to just go by those houses and look at all the Christmas lights. You know, that was fun. You know, we had a lot of fun. We used to go to the beach.
But Kathy and her family moved back to New Mexico and the Navajo Reservation.
So the reason why we moved back from California is because, you know, my parents had a big family and they were really close. They wanted to be closer to their family after my grandmother had passed away. And we're still here.
And does all of that sound familiar? Do you have a similar story or are you still living in the city because of relocation? Give us a call and tell us your experience. How did you feel about being a Native in the big city? Or dial in and tell us why you and your family came back. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us on the line today from Los Angeles, California, is Pamela Peters. She's a multimedia Indigenous documentarian, and she is Navajo. It's our pleasure to have her here with us as well, and our pleasure to hear from listeners. Let's go ahead and do more of that right now. We're going to say hi to Delson in Warm Springs, Oregon, listening on KWSO. Delson, thanks for calling. And what would you like to add?
Good morning. In 1965, I came out of high school and the BIA education specialist contacted me and asked me to come into his office, and he talked to me. I had little understanding of what he was talking about, but it sounded pretty good. And he said that I could pick any city in the United States to go to, and they would pay for my schooling. I was married at the time and had one child, and he said I could take them along and they would pay us the subsistence and take care of us while I was going to school, and I could choose any trade I wanted. And I really didn't want to go to school for a trade, but it was the great offer. And then I went and told my mom, and she said, no, don't do it. She said, you can't trust the government. Never trust the government. They have another reason for why they're doing what they're doing. And I said, come on, Mom. It's a contract. Government's going to sign it, and I'm going to sign it, and it's a deal. And up until I got on the train in Portland and left with my small family at that time, she cried right up to the, us getting on the train, begging me not to go. But I went, and when we got there, they put us in a hotel on State Street, and I turned on the TV, and news was on, and there's about 30 Indians. I'm just guessing on that, but there's quite a few Indians getting marched out of a condemned building in one part of Chicago. And I said, man, this is embarrassing. You know, why don't they get a job? You know, this ain't right. And so I changed the channel, and another news channel, another part of Chicago, about 25 Indians were getting escorted out of a condemned building. And I was like, Jesus, this is not good. I shut the TV off. But to make the long story short, that was in October of 65. And by January 29th, I came back from school, and there's about 6 foot of snow in Chicago at that time. And it was 29 degrees below zero and 64 degrees below zero with the wind chill factor coming off of Lake Michigan. And the BIA education specialist was in my apartment when I got there, and I went, he's never come, what's going on here?
And wow. And Delson, I'm sure just hearing the small part of what you lived through, and thinking about going away, even just very touching, hearing, you know, your own mother being worried about this. And I know there are a lot of people who have similar stories. And what we walk away from all of this with is really important, and why we wanted to do this program today, because we know there is quite the legacy when it comes to relocation and people going away from their tribal communities and all the things it led to, both good and bad. And Delson, we're going to keep thinking of you as we continue here with this hour. And speaking of Chicago, I want to go ahead and bring in another guest who is in Chicago. We have Dr. Doreen Wiese, and she's the president of the American Indian Association of Illinois, and she is Minnesota Chippewa. Dr. Wiese, welcome to the hour.
Hi. Boy, there's been some great stories on your show today.
Certainly. And anything you want to share? Delson really opened up a great space for us. Any comments?
I worked in education here in Chicago for the last 50 years. I didn't come on relocation. I came to go to school here, but worked with a lot of Indian people that did come on relocation. And especially I worked in a community college in the 80s and 90s. And we got a lot of people that were trained in relocation, and their jobs were already gone. They were things like typewriter repair, TV repair, things like that. They weren't jobs that were going to last for the people. And so they were still here really struggling to survive. There were some, you know, during the 70s and early 80s, there were a lot of factory jobs in Chicago. So a lot of Indian people worked there, and they could make a really good living. But then those started to go too. So by the early 80s, people were really struggling. And as the jobs started, even though there's a lot of jobs here, but the jobs, the high-paying jobs, were leaving. I wanted to just tell one success story. The head of our dance company is he's Zuni, and he came here on relocation in 1965. And he trained. He had 2 years of training, though, to be a heavy equipment mechanic. And at that time, heavy equipment mechanics were making $50 an hour. Remember, this is 1965. And with overtime, $75 an hour. So that was in big contrast to myself. Let's say I was probably a clerk at that time, a typist, and I was making $1.75. So that kind of shows you, you know, that was one person that was trained in a skill that, and he stayed. He stayed in Chicago and worked that and retired being a heavy-duty mechanic, and contributed, I think, you know, when we talked about, they contributed to really the community and all the people that lived here, and that he brought his culture, his language, his songs and dances with him to Chicago, and actually in the 1980s started a dance troupe for and taught a lot of songs and dances to children here. He had a dance group of 75 children. So I think those are, and then a lot of people that came to Chicago, they went on to higher education. They went on to the community college. We also had the only urban American Indian college here. It was Nace College, and a lot of people got their bachelor's degrees from that. And probably most returned home to their reservations, and most of the people on relocation did return. So that a lot of people, they gained skills here, and they brought it back to the tribes, and some of them became tribal chairmen and tribal chairwomen, and they did find work on the reservations.
Sure, and you know, when we think of relocation, there is no one story, just like our Native lives. There is no one Native story. There's a lot of diversity, too. And Dr. Wiese, I want to hear also a little bit about when people did come to the cities and creating almost an urban tribe. I want to hear more about that, too. But folks, if there's anything you want to add, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Dr. Wiese, we're going to say hello to Al in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KUNM. Al, thank you for calling, and you're on air. All right, let's try another caller. Let's go ahead and say hello to Lisbeth in Standing Rock, North Carolina, tuned in on KLND. Lisbeth, thank you for your call, and what would you like to share?
I went on relocation in 71. To Los Angeles, and I ended up going to school in Anaheim, California. But what I really like to share is that the person did say I could say names. So A. David Lester and Ranlett Edmonds and Howard Yakis, they started the Indian Center there in Los Angeles. And they also started the powwow at Long Beach at Hughes Aircraft. And then they moved on to San Diego. They started the Indian Center in San Diego.
And Elizabeth, how do you think all of that helped people who were transitioning?
They did. They helped us with everything when we went on relocation, turned on our lights, helped us make our payments, and not make our payments, but how to do it and go to school. And I worked for Bank of America for 10 years before I decided to come home. But my parents were ill, and I just made the choice to come home, but they did start all that and combined all the reservation, Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma. They're originally from Oklahoma, but they got all the Indians together and kept their traditions going.
Wow. And Lisbeth, do you know if the Dave Lester you're talking about, the late Dave Lester, is the one who created the energy group? I wonder.
And,
wow. And it goes right in line with hearing that, you know, what Dr. Wiese just said, that a lot of people went on to create great things in their community after coming home. Elizabeth, thank you for that. And again, folks, if you want to reach out to us, 1-800-99-NATIVE is the number. Let's try Al again. Al in Albuquerque, listening on KUNM. Are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Go ahead. Share your thoughts.
Yeah, my name is Al Cross, and I'm in town visiting a son who lives here. Originally, I'm from North Dakota, but then I relocated to San Jose in 1960. So I'm an early relocatee, kind of watching that transition. But I just wanted to let you know that we're doing an relocation, American Indian relocation exhibit this fall in that area, in Los Gatos, at the Los Gatos Museum there in California. And we'll be talking about the same thing, that mainly the stories, trying to get the stories of people, because there's a lot of wonderful stories that took place in this big movement. I always said that there's been three large movements of Indians over the history. First was the Removal Act back in 1830, then World War II, And then if you look at this particular era, this relocation area, again, it changed the whole Indian world. Now that we have a good maybe 65% of the American Indians are urbanized, both, you know, metropolitan and rural urbanization. But mainly we're just trying to catch, you know, some of these same stories that you're hearing here today. And my sister lives here also, so she was a relocatee too after Haskell Institute. So all of them have stories that are wonderful. And it's a very vital part, I think, of American Indian history. And we should look at it because it tells us things about, particularly about ourselves and about the country, what took place when that particular program was formulated.
And Al, it's great that you're doing something to make sure that those stories are shared. Al, is there any contacts or things people should be on the lookout for to know when that exhibit is going to take place or if you're asking for stories? Go ahead.
We're asking for stories. Well, we already had one big dinner, kind of a reunion dinner, trying to get names of people, and we had a fairly good turnout, about 30 people. So it'll be on Facebook. We'll have a site on Facebook, and in the Bay Area, people are familiar with the San Jose area. That's where I live. We'll try our best to make it known. We're going to look at trying to get it movable so we can go down and show it in Los Angeles and maybe up in Sacramento and a couple other places, but just to kind of get people thinking about it in the terms of these are stories that are just about like at the end of World War II. They were out trying to collect stories from World War II veterans. You know, they're disappearing real fast. And
we have to be able to make sure that we're getting those. Al, please do us a favor. Reach out to us when you have details as well. Send us an email, post it on Facebook, or send us a tweet too. But we do appreciate you calling in. And Dr. Wiese, just talking about people coming together, I definitely want to make sure that we have a moment where we do talk about some of those unions that were made, not just the ones in marriage, but also tribal communities coming together in these urban centers. Anything you want to shed light on?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that came out of Chicago that where Indian people came together for the first time. The tribes came together at the University of Chicago in 1960 and began to realize that coming together was going to be our strength. How things have changed, though, a lot today is that what has happened, while most people, Indian people, do live off reservations, like Chicago is one of the eighth largest centers, even though a lot of our people have gone home, there are still other people here. And we're from about 150 different tribes, so that's a lot of tribes to work with. But currently the federal government has decided that they don't want to fund urban communities. So while we had a lot of funding right after relocation in the 1970s to build schools and clinics and colleges and all that money left in the mid-80s. So we've really been, we've had our population continues to grow, but the funding for urban communities has continued to decline over that time. And it's really, it's devastating our people because whatever initiatives you see come out of Washington, where the president talks about youth initiatives or anti-drug initiatives or, you know, whatever they discuss, the president will never say the word urban. And or off reservation, and there's a reason for that. They don't want to fund the majority of Indian people where they live. And so when you're talking about, we really do need a new coming together so that people will see the needs of all Indian people and help them, because we have so many people that are homeless, children without daycare. We have hardly no programs in the public schools for them. So these are no programs at all for high school dropouts. And so this is a huge, gigantic need, and we're trying to build really movement, a coalition of people that will get Washington to address the needs of these are really now the descendants of people that came on relocation.
And Dr. Wiese, with that said, what about putting some of this on tribes as well, supporting their tribal members wherever they want to call home?
Exactly. I believe that the money should follow the Indian. We have, out of 150 tribes, we only have three tribes that have a presence in Chicago that are supporting their members, and those are the Ho-Chunk and the Menominee, and there's only two, I'm forgetting, there might be another one, but those are the two that come to mind. And that's important because the tribes are getting funding for all their members when most of their members don't live on the reservation. So that money, that funding is not getting to the members, and Washington believes that it is. And the reality is it's not. Our people here are getting not 1 cent for housing, not 1 cent for daycare, not 1 cent for elder care, not 1 cent for youth, for dropout and youth initiatives, not 1 cent for justice initiatives. So you can see that it's just not happening. And I know that from personal stories of people that come to our organization for help. And when we try to work with the tribes, their reaction is, well, you know, just silence, or no, we can't, we can't help them. And so, I mean, it's just really, it's devastating to the people that are here now with jobs, with there are fewer jobs, and they can't get help from their tribes.
And folks, if you want to comment on that, please do reach out to us. Send us an email, comments@NativeAmericaCalling.com. And when it does come to what people face in urban communities, what else are you facing? Are there any challenges that you feel deserve a full hour on our program? We'd love to hear from you. comments@NativeAmericaCalling.com. And of course, we are on Facebook and Twitter too, if there's anything on that you'd like to share. I want to go ahead and bring back Pamela Peters, who's with us too. She's a multimedia Indigenous documentarian. And Pamela, we've heard a lot this year and heard about some projects out there. You also have one. I also wanted to give you a moment to share details on that in case somebody was interested in hearing another perspective on the whole thought of relocation and our Native nations.
With my projects, is that what you're...
Yeah, tell us more about the legacy of exiled NDNZ.
I did a small project that was kind of a continuation of what Kent McKinsey did with the exiles from 1961, and I did a short film. It initially just started out as a photography project where I just wanted to bring to light about the relocation program to a younger generation. And so I used seven young adults that I knew here in the community. They're all from different tribes. And I had them dress up in 50s, 60s attire, and we took photos at some of the historical sites where a lot of the relocated natives came out here back in the 60s. And as I was interviewing them, I realized that some of them didn't even know about relocation, and some of them were actually product, second, third generation of relocated natives. And it really addressed to this generation, to the youth, about learning about how they came about of living here in the city. So that pretty much like expanded and opened up a new dialogue for a lot of natives out here. And from that, I just started really capturing a lot of stories from different communities and also from elders. And I'm doing little small vignettes of tribal communities out here and also hearing individual stories. So it's grown into something quite amazing. And then just learning about the young trailblazers that came out here during the 60s and how they wanted to help the natives that were that unfortunately, you know, wound up on the streets, kind of similar to what one of the callers was mentioning about being homeless and addicted to drugs and alcohol and living in the skirts of Skid Row. And learning about these, you know, young adults that were wanting to help them. And I know that one of the callers mentioned A. David Lester. And A. David Lester was actually one of the founders of the United American Indian Involvement Agency at 118 Winston Street back in 1974. And that was one of the first centers that helped a lot of displaced natives and wanting to get up, you know, needed help to get off drugs and sober up. And that goes back to into how we as a community, we want to help each other. And we've come together in that Pan-Indian community, and we may be from different tribes, and, you know, in historical past we may have battled, but living here in the city, we've come together and we really want to help each other. And that's what I love about Los Angeles, is that we have a large Native community. We have all these Native centers. We have UAII, AICC, the American Indian Community Council. We have the Southern California Indian Center, where I lived. Well, actually, lived there for a while by working there. I worked there for about 4 years.
Sure, and that place, I'm sure, is always home. And Pamela, we are getting tight on time, and I want to make sure that people are able to connect to your project. Please do share how they do reach you.
You can see my work at my website, which is PamelaJPeters.com, and my project, Exile Indians, NDNZ.com.
All right. Thank you for that. And folks, that's going to wrap up today's discussion. Thanks again to our guests, Pamela Peters and Dr. Doreen Wiese. Join us again tomorrow for another lively conversation right here on our electronic talking circle. And for more on our program, visit us online at NativeAmericaCalling.com. And we also want to remind you that this Friday, we are going to jump into a special broadcast taking Studio 49 on the road. We'll be coming to you live from the Gathering of Nations. Please do tune in, and we look forward to meeting folks and connecting you directly to what's going on. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our senior producer is Monica Brain. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. And Stephen Emmons is our engineer. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host and producer, Tara Gatewood. And we look forward to reconnecting with you right here on our electronic talking circle. And if you haven't done it yet, visit our website and sign up for our newsletter. Thanks a lot. We'll be back tomorrow.
I was a broken human being. I drank to take away the pain, and I used it as an escape. I had many day ones, but the very last day one for me was cathartic. I just knew I had to quit. I needed to be there for my children. And when I'm drinking alcohol, I'm not there for them.
Find out how you can start your day one at NativeAmericaCalling.com. Program support by the Gathering of Nations Powwow, April 29th and 30th in Albuquerque, New Mexico, inviting thousands of dancers and championship drum groups. You can visit Powwow Alley, the Indian Traders Market, and join the music action on Stage 49 along with crowning Miss Indian World. Saturday morning in the pit before the grand entry, it's the music of Judith Hill, a finalist from The View TV show. Gathering of Nations, North America's biggest powwow, April 29th and 30th. Info at Gathering of Nations.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.